we really have to think about how do we create an opening, a space, because that's where, in my experience, in my view, that's where we can have the chance of encountering the reality of God's presence in ways that sort of just break in and surprise us. Because that presence is always there. I mean, God is closer to us than we are to ourselves. But we constantly do so much else that doesn't give the opening and the space for us to realize that. And so I think that's a primary calling to any who are in pastoral leadership.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Pivot Podcast, where we explore how the church can faithfully navigate a changing world. I'm Alicia Granholm.
Hi, and I'm Terry Elton. Today, we're honored to welcome Wes Granberg Michelson, whose remarkable journey spans across more than 5 decades of church leadership. He's worked with the U.S. Senate during the Vietnam War. He's led denominations and global ecumenical initiatives. And what makes Wes's perspective so valuable for us today is that he's not just observed the church's challenges from the outside. He's lived through massive cultural changes and institutional shifts that have taken place in nearly every kind of leadership role imaginable.
And throughout it all, Wes has kept journals documenting both his inner journey alongside his outward work. And recently, Wes spent a year reading through 50 years of those journals and discovered patterns about what actually sustains leaders for the long haul and what causes them to burn out or even harm others when their inner lives remain unexamined. At a time when so many church leaders today are exhausted, discouraged, or wondering if they have what it takes to keep going, Wes's wisdom about integrating our inward and our outward journeys can help us better understand how the attention we give to our own souls is not self-indulgent. Rather, it's actually essential for faithful and sustainable leadership. Wes, we are so grateful to have you on the podcast today. Welcome.
Well, thanks very much. It's really an honor and delight for me. Good to meet both of you, Alicia and Terry.
Wes, great to have you here. You and I were recently, this last May, at a conference with church pastors. One of the things that I really appreciated with you in that journey, these were a number of senior pastors, is how you acknowledge this tension between these external demands that they're facing and the need to tend their internal work. And I think often we as church leaders feel guilty about that or think our spiritual practices are kind of what we're supposed to do on our own time. But talk about this tension and how you have come to really engage with church leaders to just highlight how important it is to do this inner work.
Well, thanks. Thanks a lot, Terry. I think in my experience, I had to learn that if you weren't taking care of your inward journey, or just let's say taking care of your soul, the kind of the center of your being, your ability for outward leadership in one way or another, and sooner or later, is going to be really harmed. I saw that happening in colleagues, and I always wanted to be attentive to that myself. One way I like to put it, Terry, is that only the pain you name is available for transformation. And the pain you don't name, you will transmit to others. And I see that happening constantly. And so paying attention to your inward life, in my case, I happen to like writing journals. That became a real tool for me. It's not for everyone, but for me, it really worked. And what I was trying to do was simply process the pain and the grace in my life. And we all have to find a way to do that if we're going to be effective in the sort of leadership and service we're called to do.
I love that, Wes. As a fellow journaler, I too have found just how helpful that practice has been over the years, just processing life, right? And for me, life with God, and I've just found that the actual act of writing, physically writing, you know, today, especially when we have computers and phone, digital phones at our fingertips, I still find the practice of physically writing out, you know, thoughts and prayers and just processing with God in that way so incredibly beneficial. Wes, as you look at, you know, this emerging generation of leaders right now facing what some might say, and you might disagree based on, you know, the various challenges that you personally have seen, but, you know, unprecedented challenges and rapidly changing culture. What wisdom or encouragement would you most want to pass along to church leaders in this moment?
Well, I think the first thing I'd say is what we'd already covered. If you're going to be effective in leadership, you've got to establish what I like to call, and what I called in my book, a holding space. You've got to put together an infrastructure that is going to take care of your inward spiritual life, and from that, your psychological and moral well-being as well. And that, as you said, Alicia, it may be journaling, it may be different forms of reading the scripture, a whole variety of ways to pray, going on retreat, being close to creation and nature, doing yoga. It could be all manner of things, but no one is going to do this for you. You've got to do it yourself. No board, no congregation, no consistory, etc. And I think it has to start there. And then I'd say to those who are in congregational ministry now, you're probably in a situation where you look out at a congregation that's full of gray hair and people are over 60, because that's what most mainline congregations are like now. But don't let that be all that you see. And don't let that sort of be a source of discouragement. I think some other things are happening as well. There's a real thirst for belonging today. And it's partly driven by social media, by a lot of other stuff. People want direct experiences of community and belonging. And my friend Diana Butler Bass likes to say, and she's right, we go now from belonging to believing. We don't go from believing to belonging. And a congregation can really provide that in a variety of ways. And also people are searching for some sense of transcendent reality. They want to believe in a world where there's more than just what is materially in front of them. Not everyone, but there's a thirst for that. And I think congregations have the ability to provide that sort of access and to do it in creative ways. So I'd say, you know, you have to start by asking, what is God up to both in our congregation and what is God up to outside of our congregation? And how do we learn to join that instead of, you know, worrying about, where are we going to be 5 years from now when a lot of these people have passed on and we're not going to be able to pay our bills?
Yeah, that's really helpful. And I kind of got stuck at the first part when you're like, you got to deal with your own pain and your own inner work, and no one's going to hold you accountable, right? No one's going to push that. Mm-hmm. And probably no one knows the depth of what that is except for you. Mm-hmm. And that seems pretty bold and pretty important to what you offered. I guess I just want to highlight that for those that are listeners. If you're hearing a nudge, maybe this is another nudge to pay attention, mm-hmm. to do the work.
Mm-hmm. You used the word pay attention, and I want to jump off on that if I could. Look, we live in what some people call an attention economy, meaning that economic forces today are driven to get our attention to what they want. And that's why billions of dollars are going into all the tech companies, into the, you know, it's why the stock market is going up. It's AI is making this even speedier and faster. And it's all about driving our attention in order to make money. And that happens on our screens, happens on our phones. It happens everywhere more intensively than it has. And the problem is that attention is a limited commodity. We can only give so much of it. And we have to pay attention to where we pay attention. Otherwise, it's going to happen to us. And I think it was Henry Nouwen that I first heard say, prayer is attention. The kind of environment we face, that pastors face, that those in our congregations face, it requires, I think, some spiritual grounding in order to know how do we give attention to where we need to give attention. And that, as I say, I mean, I think it requires a spiritual practice that we have to develop.
Yeah, and all of the practices that you had talked about earlier are about slowing that down, right? Mm-hmm. Journaling, yoga, being in nature, right?
Yep.
It slows down, and it heightens our awareness as it does that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it opens space, and I think that's the most important thing, because our lives are so crowded. They're so crowded by stuff that comes into us from the outside, and they're crowded by just the demands of the commitments we've made. I mean, you know, if you're a family and you've got three kids who are between 7 and 12, I mean, you're taking them to hockey practice, to soccer matches, to yoga, to one thing after another. We are in this period of this intense parenting, which tends to kind of drive out room for other stuff. We really have to think about how do we create an opening, a space, because that's where, in my experience, in my view, that's where we can have the chance of encountering the reality of God's presence in ways that sort of just break in and surprise us. Because that presence is always there. I mean, God is closer to us than we are to ourselves. But we constantly do so much else that doesn't give the opening and the space for us to realize that. And so I think that's a primary calling to any who are in pastoral leadership.
So Wes, you've witnessed massive shifts over your 5 decades of leading in the church and just in the world. And you've been in so many different angles as you've witnessed that. As you think about the significant shifts that have taken place in culture and the church, what does that reveal, and what insights might that give us for those of us that are looking ahead to the church and trying to connect with the world today?
Yeah. Sort of like, you know, you answer that and you've got to figure it out. I've been in different, and looked at this from different points of service, which, you know, like if it doesn't work in one way, you just try from another way and see what happens. But there have been a lot of changes. I think the most obvious one that anyone in congregational ministry knows today is that people are leaving the church. And there's been a ton of stuff written about this. Some of the people at your seminary have written about it and sort of, you know, done charts that show when will this denomination or that one no longer be around. And I think two things are true. One is that, yes, the participation of people in religious institutions is decreasing. But the other thing that is true and is not as readily recognized is that spiritual interest in curiosity continues. And these things are going on at the same time. In fact, if you look at COVID, and I think one of the things that happened in COVID is that all the changes that were already going on in culture and particularly in congregational life, they were simply accelerated. I mean, COVID was like it put the gas on the stuff that was already there. And so you've had a lot of people who stopped going or, you know, there was no more opportunity to go to physical church services. And then and then when, you know, church services started again, they were just out of the habit. And that, you know, they're just not returning. Well, but the other thing that you see is that those who are returning have a higher level of commitment. There's a shrinking in number, but I think more study has to be given to the degree of commitment of those who remain. And you see some signs of this. So you look at Gen Z, okay, you know, all this generational stuff, that's like 18 to 25. And you see only about 30% of that group attends church or a house of worship regularly. But you also find that they tend to do so about twice a month, higher than the average of others. You find that those who have that commitment or participation actually have a higher level. And I think that kind of gives a clue that there's more going on than meets the eye. And, you know, the kind of secular sort of version you hear is America's, you know, the churches are decreasing, America's becoming less and less religious, we're becoming a more secular nation, et cetera. The nuns are increasing, those who, you know, none of the above when they ask about religious commitment. But even amongst the nuns, the percentage of those who say none of the above when say what religious institution you participate in, the number of those who are atheist or agnostic is very small. They actually have a continuing level of spiritual interest or curiosity. The question is, where is it being met and where is it being expressed? So I think one of the big trends going on that I've seen over my time is that you've got a decrease in participation in formal religious institutions, but you have an increase in the intensity of those who remain and a new picture of how people are searching for spiritual meaning and reality to find some fulfillment. Well, I mean, I think a lot about the remnant. You know, I mean, I think we're going into a time when there's going to be less of those in our country. This now, if you talk about the rest of the world, you get a very different picture. But in the United States, there's going to be less people who are involved regularly in houses of worship, but there's likely to be deeper degrees of commitment and vitality within those communities. And I think one of the big questions is how do they have an effect long-term in the witness for the gospel from a Christian point of view and in the life of society?
I would agree. I think we've seen that and mm-hmm. wondered about that as well. Wes, as you look back on your various decades of leadership, is there anything that you wish you had understood differently about leading change through those different changes at the time?
This is wise Wes talking to younger Wes.
Yes, right. Yeah, exactly.
Well, yeah, there's a Celtic poet you probably have heard of, David White. I love his stuff. And he wrote a poem called What to Remember Upon Wakening. And one of his lines I keep repeating: what you can plan is too small for you to live. What you can plan is too small for you to live. I wish I had known that when I started out. I think we are addicted to planning and control in our, you know, in the way society functions, and that kind of infiltrates into the church. I think you've probably seen my comments about I never want to do another strategic plan. I've done plenty, and what you see happening is that the events in life and the events in the world simply overwhelm them. You look, I mean, all you have to do is look at the past, say, 6-7 years of religious and cultural life, and we've got about anywhere between 320 and 350,000 congregations in the United States. So COVID affected every single one of them and brought a crisis into each one that they had to figure out. And that wasn't in anyone's plan. And you go to larger things in society, and it's the same way. You folks there at Luther were close to the epicenter of the George Floyd murder. And that produced a whole range of reactions in the church and society that, and then counter reactions to them that we're still reeling from, and that also were never predicted, were never, you know, put into any clear plan, and that we couldn't control. Or you even look at events that have affected many parts of the United States, climate events and forest fires, fires that have wiped out parts of cities and have threatened. And these also show how things happen that you can't predict or control, but that present existential issues that you have to deal with. I happen to think the same thing is true in our personal lives. So the qualities of resilience and of building an organization or a congregation, whatever, that has the adaptability to both recognize and welcome unexpected things as a means for fulfilling their own role, it takes a change in how we think and adapt to organizations. And I think for congregations, that's very, very true. And for congregations, we should be able to do that well, because we're supposed to know about the way in which the Holy Spirit acts within our life and is ahead of us acting in the world. And the Holy Spirit always did unpredictable things and continues to be. So I wish that I had been more attuned to that kind of thinking, instead of, you know, looking at, for instance, the Reformed Church in America when I started, and figuring out, you know, we've got structures that are, you know, at least 50 years old, so we got to restructure everything, we got to reprioritize, we got to make new arrangements, we got to have a good strategic plan, we got et cetera, et cetera. Now, there's a role for some of that stuff, but it's changing the culture of an institution from a congregation on up. That's by far more important, and it's also more difficult. You know, the line you've probably heard that I started repeating a lot: culture eats strategy for lunch. And I would urge any in church leadership today to figure out how to give more attention to organizational culture. And I wish I had done that earlier.
Wes, for people who maybe became nervous when they heard you say that you're done with 5-year strategic plans, I would love to know, how would you encourage them to become more in tune with what the Holy Spirit is doing in their daily life, in the community's life? How do people make that shift, or what has been your experience about how people can make that shift? Because I think you're right. I don't think people are aware enough of what the Holy Spirit is doing and recognize that that is actually the work that we are called to. And yes, as somebody who loves strategy, right, like they can coexist as long as we're being faithful actually to what God is up to. Mm-hmm. But in your experience, how did you make that shift?
Well, I think in two ways, Alicia. The first is what we've already talked about, namely, you've got to nurture the space within your own life to be open and attentive, especially if you're, I mean, okay, so I was, you know, in this position called general secretary. So it was a pretty intense, busy job. But, you know, I don't know if it was any more intense or busy than the job of pastoring a complex congregation. I mean, you know, we're the people who are listening to this podcast are in pretty tough, demanding roles that just fill a lot of their lives. And if you don't have the ability to curate a kind of an infrastructure to open your life to a space to really understand or to really try to discern what's happening, you're not going to have a chance. This, you know, this detachment, it's really interesting. I learned, and I think this is important for any pastor, to be really effective, you have to develop a certain attachment from the institution that you're giving your life to. You got to be able to step back from it in order to see more broadly. And if you want any hope of having a prophetic word and a prophetic presence, you're not going to do that unless you're able to also withdraw in the best way. You know, Bill Heifetz's Leadership on the Line, he has the example of going up to the balcony and looking down at what you're doing. I mean, there are lots of metaphors for this, but I think they're really true, and really important. And so that's required at just a personal level, and then at the institutional level. The problem with Protestant denominations and especially mainline and all of our structures, we're so filled with complex processes of governance, you know, and if we're in, and because we're, I mean, to put it this way, you know, we're in the tradition of the Reformation. I mean, we're celebrating, by the time people hear this, we will have celebrated Reformation Sunday. And so we could talk about all the good things that the Reformation did, and then the necessary things. But frankly, they also bred systems of polity that are based on mistrust. You know, you can't trust any center of power without having another countervailing one. And you don't want anyone, in any position for too long without replacing them. And you can't really trust a system unless there's all these countervailing forces, because we're so afraid that someone's going to abuse authority. Well, okay, I think the reaction against hierarchical authority was absolutely necessary in the Reformation, but it could breed a system whereby the way pastors are gathered together into the broader life of the church or the life of the denomination is for processes of governance, which usually are messy, they're detailed, they usually involve conflict. There are very few people who really enjoy this, and it tends to diminish the sense of appreciation for the structures themselves. So what you most need to do, and I found this when in my service with the Reformed Church of America, and I mean, shared it with my Lutheran colleagues as well, you got to figure out how you build space within the structures themselves, how you create meetings, gatherings that don't have a governance purpose. How you gather together pastors not to make any decision or to be told anything about church programs, but to really share in their life together and in what they're discovering from one another. You have to build communities at a local level where you gather pastors or other church leaders from more than one denomination to simply reflect on, what did they see happening? What is God up to within the community where we live? What can we learn from one another? Those are the contexts where you begin to really understand what the Spirit is doing. But you got to kind of create the openings within our structures to allow that to have a chance to happen.
I really appreciate that. I just returned from 3.5 days with a fall theological conference. A lot of the ELCA synods gather in the fall for a few days together. And I was just so impressed that it was a learning event, but that's what they did, Wes. There was a lot of space, and you could tell relationally the synod was in a good place with each other. They have hard work to do, for sure, right? That was not up for grabs. That was not a question. But the spirit with which they were with each other, the spirit of prayer time and worship time was as vital for them. And I think that's an example of how you can do that on a synod level, but you could do it organically, right, with colleagues next to you, or in your own leadership meetings that you're doing at a congregational level.
We started doing this in the Reformed Church in America, where we were trying to get at how do you really nurture congregational revitalization, and we found that one of the most helpful things was building networks of pastors in contexts that were purely for their own accountability, their own relationship. It had nothing to do with the governance structure, and we work with the Lilly Foundation, which, as you know, is the church's one foundation. I think we got around $4 to $5 million over a few years. And all we did what, they helped us do what we should have been doing anyway, gathering pastors into mutually supportive networks, which their research says is one of the most important things to pastoral excellence. So the work that Craig Dykstra did during his time. It really proved to be true. And we used to, when I met with the leaders of other denominations during my time, from ELCA, it was Mark Hansen, whom I got to know very well, and Cliff Kirkpatrick from Presbyterian Church USA, so forth. But we used to talk about these things all the time, like how do we look at our structures and figure out how to get more breathing space into them.
So I got one last really big question for you. Are you ready for it?
Sure.
Okay. Recently, you wrote about feeling angry that certain expressions of Christianity have reshaped the public image of what it means to follow Jesus. I heard that a lot in the gathering that I just came from. Mm-hmm. So that's part of what drives this question. How should church leaders think about an authentic Christian witness when this cultural brand of Christianity is at best complicated, but at worst divisive?
Well, I think it's huge, and there are a couple things. One is that in the secular society now, in the society broadly, Christianity has such a terrible brand because it's associated with a kind of Christian nationalism, with an ascension, with a particular form of greatness, etc. I don't have to say a lot more, but it's the reason why surveys show why a lot of people just drop out. It builds loyalty with some, but a lot of people just drop out. And so in the face of that, I think the first thing we have to do is say, look, the response to this isn't to kind of walk away and condemn. The response to this is to really live out what the gospel is supposed to be like in building a community. That's going to be a community where we don't demonize our opponents. But it's also going to be a community where we learn how to sink into the truth of the gospel. And as happens in many times, sinking into that truth puts us at odds with other cultural trends and political trends that are going on. And we can't walk away from that. We can't think, well, the answer to the problems in our time are to just get politics out of the church, whatever that means. I mean, you don't want any partisan politics from the pulpit, but the only way you get anything political out of the church is by not preaching about Jesus and ignoring the lectionary. I mean, there's just a reality in the way in which the truth of the gospel intersects with what's going on in culture. Now, I think the deepest failure of mainline Christianity, and I could talk about evangelical and Catholic as well, in the past 20 years, has been the failure of Christian formation. I mean, we've done a terrible job at discipleship, a terrible job at really shaping people and what it means to be Christian. And I think we're reaping the results of that now. That's part of what we're seeing. I like to look back to the example of Bonhoeffer, not for, you know, the fact that he was involved in this plot against Hitler, so forth. That's kind of what he's popularly known for. But what did Bonhoeffer do in this time when he saw the mainline German church being so completely nationalized in a form of idolatry and et cetera? He gathered a group together and formed them into a community and in a seminary. And he prayed with them, and they did the Psalms together. Because he was convinced there had to be a deeper process of formation in order to meet the test of the time. And I think that is exactly the situation that we're in today. You mentioned the book that I just wrote called The Soul Work of Justice, Four Movements of Contemplative Action. It's really about that premise, namely that our real work for justice won't happen unless we deepen the sense of who we are spiritually and find those roots and then build that in a community. That I think is what our time really calls us to.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. And Wes, thank you for your time today and for sharing your wisdom and your journals in many ways, and reminding us about how the inner and external journey of leadership is so vital as we think about faithful leadership in any time, but particularly in the particularities of our time today. So thank you for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Terry, and thank you, Alicia.
Oh, we're so grateful to have you, Wes. And to our audience, thank you so much for joining us for this episode of the Pivot Podcast. We would love it if you could help spread the word about Pivot. Please like and subscribe if you are catching us on YouTube. Leave a review on your favorite podcast platform and share Pivot with a friend. Thanks, and we'll see you next time.
The Pivot Podcast is a production of Luther Seminary's Faith Lead. Faith Lead is an ecosystem of theological resources and training designed to equip Christian disciples and leaders to follow God into a faithful future. Learn more at faithlead.org.